Boker Tov or Tzaraim Tovim for those in Israel. Okay, we're in Perek Beit, Perek Dalet in Perkei Avot, Mishnah Gimel. Last week we discussed Ben Azeh running to a light mitzvah, heavy mitzvah, speaking Hebrew, and I guess in honor of Yerushalayim, that's how the Rambam defines a light mitzvah. And the Mishnah continues, Hu Hayah Omer, who of course is Ben Azeh. Ben Azai, what the Mishnah says when he died, Batlu Hashaktanim. When he died, the intense Torah learning all ceased. We discussed that he didn't want to get married. He married Torah, and as married to Torah, he didn't have patience or time or inclination to change diapers or go shopping. And discussed it's not really right. But if it's really, really done, we don't have people like this, but if he dedicates his entire life to teaching Torah, so the Rambam writes he's not sinning. But we can understand why the Mishnah in Sota lists off what changes happen when people die. It's actually a very interesting Mishnah. It's the Mishnah, it's one of the few Mishnayot that talk about what will be in the Messianic era. The trees in Israel will grow beautifully, and the fruit, and all kinds of different things. The Mishnah says some positive, some kind of negative. The generation will sort of disrespect its elders, and the young will want to take over. So the Mishnah there lists off a whole series. When Rebbe died, when Rabbi Akiva died, Batel Kavod HaTorah, the honor for Torah ceased. That's some explain, I believe, that people used to originally stand. When Moshe got the Torah, you know, we stand. Rav Soloveitchik explains, I'm sure many of you know, there's a minhag of some people, they stand for Kriyat HaTorah. So we assume most people sit, I'm sure in all your shuls, there are people who they like to stand. Rav Soloveitchik explained, when we stand for Kriyat HaTorah, we're reenacting Mamad Har Sinai. It's a reenact. And when we sit for learning Torah, we're learning Torah. There's a rabbinic decree that we should have public Torah reading. It's very nice to learn Torah. When we stand for Torah, we're reenacting Mamad Har Sinai. Anyway, the Mishnah lists off when different people died, so different, we know that this or the end of an era, so to speak. So when Ben Azai died, the end of the era was people whose Torah is primary and nothing else. The people who are super dedicated to Torah died with Ben Azai. Okay, so the Mishnah says, Alte hu ayomer, he would say, Altehi baz l'chol adam, v'altehi mafleg l'chol davar. Do not be baz, a bizayon. Do not degrade anybody, l'chol adam, v'altehi mafleg l'chol davar. Do not separate. We'll come back to exactly what that means. She'ein lecha adam she'ein lo sha'ah. There is no person who doesn't have their hour, right? I think in English, the expression every dog has its, you know, day. Ve'ein lecha davar she'ein lo makom. And there's no place, there's no thing that doesn't have a place. So let's try to, analyze this a little bit more. So, al tei baz l'chol adam. Do not look down on anybody. So, of course, we know everybody's created in the image of God. Sometimes at heart, that's the famous story. When somebody complained, I forget now who the Amor, they complained to, why are you so ugly? You know, and what do you mean, why so ugly? I think it's the rabbi said to the woman, why are you so ugly? And the woman said, why don't you ask the person who created me? That was a real shtach, you know, like, you're big knucker, you rabbi should know better. But so everybody's created B'Tzelem Elohim. Okay, but what the Bartanur explains is, you know, we all know this. Sometimes the littlest guy can bring the most powerful person down. You know, very often people, let's say you want to look in the political realm, you know, people are always... are protecting themselves or where their greatest threat is coming from. And sometimes it comes from the most unexpected places. And sometimes somebody, you know, you think is a nobody turns into somebody. So that's, you never know. You never know what's going to result. So on that level, of course, it's a practical piece of advice that you'd be silly to disdain people because you never know what can come back to bite you. The things you do, who knows, if you put people down or you denigrate them, what can happen? The Tiferet Yisrael explains more what sort of we started on, that when you denigrate somebody, you're really denigrating God. That it's not so much as a practical thing, that don't hurt somebody because they may come and hurt you, but How can you denigrate anything that's created by God? So it's a much more, you call it a theological, philosophical, statement. That's the Alte Bas L'chol Adam. Alte Maflig L'chol Davar. Now, what's L'haflig? L'haflig is to separate or divide. You know, in Aramaic, the Gemara is a pluta is a argument, a division. When you divide things, palginan dibura. So L'haflig, and that's why we said an argument, a debate in Talmud is called a plukta, means there's a separation and there's a division. So alte maflig the kol davar means you should not be, literally means you should not be divided from anything. Everything has its place. So it's interesting, and I think, and very in a sense, you know, tragically in light of last week's events at Meiron, so the Bartanura, who's the classical commentary on the Mishnah, says a person should never say the danger is very far away. He's saying like, don't worry, what's the big deal? Nothing's going to happen. That's so he says no, that, and of course this is especially true of leaders. You know, leaders always have a greater level of responsibility that they have to have. So a person should never say that what I have to worry about it. It's what are the chances something is going to happen. Alti maflig l'chol davar. You never know where danger is lurking. That's like what we call, I think they call a black swan event, right? We know everything. I forget the name of the guy who wrote the book. Talib, I think, was the name of the author of the book. I don't know if anybody read the book, the black swan. He was a an investment guy. He was in the world of finance, and or he started analyzing finance, you know, and this guy's amazing, you know, 15% return every year. And he basically said it's a lot of it is luck. You know, let's say you have a 50-50 chance of guessing the direction of the market. And let's say you take 1,000 people. So after 10 years, there's going to be like four people by luck. You know, the first year down to 500, then 250, 125, 62, you keep going. So you'll have some guy out of just the luck of the draw who's going to be very good. And whatever. And then he writes that all major events of history have been kind of black swan events. They come out of nowhere. Often human nature is to try to retroactively say, we saw it coming. But nobody ever sees it coming before. Obviously, COVID is just one example. In every financial crisis we have and everything we have, nobody saw it coming. So that's what the Mishnah is saying. Yo, and that's why people don't take precautions. What's one in a million? It's going to happen. So alte maflig l'chol davar. Do not separate. You always have to be worried. And this, like I mentioned, is of course especially true to our leaders. Okay. The Tiferet Yisrael continue on this theme, and he said alte maflig l'chol davar. He writes afilu davar ma'us sanui machiv mitzair mazik. The RC, that's like a litany of terrible things. That what does it mean in English? Something hated that causes trouble, that's burdensome, that is dangerous, is poisonous. They all have value. Everything has value in life. If we don't understand, there was everything that God created for a reason. I say, let's go back to, unfortunately, our COVID example, so to speak. So, COVID came from, well, they don't know exactly, but they assume, they think it came from a bat, right? So the virus went from a bat to a human being. So one day we're going to find cures for all kinds of disease from all kinds of insects. We don't even know they exist. In other words, this is really a very theological idea that everything in this world has a purpose, but it's not just as a purpose. Everything is created for the purpose of man. That's what the Midrash says, that we were created last, so the world is prepared for man. Everything is to service man. So yes, we can't bring harm to animals, but we know that if we can kill animals to eat them even. I have to do it in a more humane way. So everything, every animal, everything that is dangerous and poisonous, there's something good that comes out of a snake. That's what the Tiferet Yisrael says. And if not now, in the future, ein lecha adam shein lo shav, ein lecha davar shein lo makom. In other words, things that now are very negative, and maybe 100 years from now will be very, very positive. We'll be able to harness something that we thought was negative into something positive. So there's everything in this world, even things that are distasteful and harmful, we have to figure out how we're going to be able to use them in a positive sense. So that's what he explains. Kind of interesting. Just to what I said before, Valtei Bas L'chol Adam, do not denigrate anybody. And we, of course, we know that Adam in biblical Hebrew, or in rabbinic Hebrew too, is a reference to all humanity, not just, you know, Jews. Reyacha is to Jews, or chavercha, your friend. Achicha, your brother. That's your fellow Jew. Adam always means all of humanity. And of course, that's the idea. We can learn from everybody. I would want to just point out that this is a comment the Torah. You know, how do you know you have to bury somebody? Right? We all know in Judaism, we bury people, you know, right away. Where does that come from? Anybody know where that's written in the Torah? You can put it in the chat box.
Isn't that from Shoftim?
Yes, it is from Kitetzeh.
Oh, Kitetzeh.
What's it talking about?
Hanging a person?
Yeah, why? Why are we hanging him?
He did something wrong.
He's a murderer. That's why.
Right.
Right. So but it's the mitzvah to bury somebody.
Elohim talui.
Correct. Kilalat Elohim talui. The curse of God is hanging or whatever. It's a hard expression. But right. The idea is that the mitzvah of burial is set by a convicted murderer. You would think, okay, he's a murderer. I don't have to bury him. Why do I have to be so honored? So that's Dafka, where the Torah says the mitzvah to bury somebody immediately is by a convicted murderer. This is a common theme throughout the entire Torah, is the Torah always puts things where you would least expect them and where you would argue it doesn't apply. Where is a lost object? Your enemy. Return the lost object of your enemy. Where do you know the laws how a husband has to treat a wife? By a slave. So The Torah always puts things where you can make an argument, you know, my enemy. And I remember in rabbinic interpretation, it's not necessarily the pshat of the pasuk, but in rabbinic interpretation, the enemy means a sinner, sort of an enemy of God. So so that's a very common idea. And the Torah here is stressing that even a convicted murderer, of course, in death, is yes, we have to kill him, but it's not because we want to kill him. It's very sad we have to kill him. Yitamu chatai minaret. We want sins to go away, not sinners. But sometimes, it was very rare, sometimes you have to kill somebody, but that person has to be treated with great respect and honor. It's really a fascinating, it's a very difficult thing to do. Most people are incapable of separating, you know, the person and the problem. And that's why the Torah, that's exactly why the Torah says you have to help your enemy load his donkey. There's a beautiful, you know, Tosfot explains very, very, very beautifully, you know, there's a mitzvah to unload an animal and there's a mitzvah to load an animal. If let's say you have two people, one's loading and one's unloading, who do you help first?
The
unloading, because we take for the animal, it's you want to get the burden off first. Yes, we can put a burden, not too heavy. There are limits to the burden you can an animal, but nonetheless, you always help unload. What happens if the person unloading the animal is your best friend and the person loading your animal, you can't see, you hate his guts. He's a sinner, a lowlife, a no good nick. So the halach is you have to help the person load the animal. You have to help the person you hate load the animal. That doesn't make any sense. Kal vachomer. I always have to help the person unload. I always have to help them first. But if it happens to be that the person of loading is a person who you hate him, then you have to help him first. It's more important because basically cognitive dissonance that if you help people, you can't hate them anymore, right? If I hated you, I wouldn't help you, right? That's the basic theme of the Sefer HaChinuch. I'm sure we must have mentioned it at some point. Actions mold character, the basic theme of Sefer HaChinuch. It's not that, I always like to say, it's not that nice people give charity. It's people who give charity are nice. In other words, when you give charity, you become a nice person. That's the Sefer HaChinuch. This is like, if you want to sum up, the compendium of 613 mitzvot. What's Sefer HaChinuch all about? It's all about actions, more character. And that's why it says mitzvah after mitzvah. Torah wants us to do things because what we do influences who we are. And not who we are influences what we do, right? Most people think, so nice people do this, nice people do that. It's not really true. It's when you do acts of kindness, you become a nice person. I think that's on a maybe more controversial or difficult level. That's why it's like to Spain sometimes, you know, and now right there are not so many left, but every once in a while, they arrest a Nazi war criminal, an evil murderer. And, you know, it's happened in Canada. After 40 years, you know, they'll arrest somebody. And his neighbors will say, I don't believe it. He was like the nicest guy. He tended to the garden and he went for walks with his wife and he had a stroller with the grandchildren. I can't believe he was a Nazi. And I don't think there's any contradiction. We're influenced by what we do. People, I mean, that's the scary part. Not all the Nazis were inherently evil, but they were doing things, whatever. I'm not, it's not for me to judge anything or anybody. Of course, you're responsible for what we do. But when you engage in evil acts, you become an evil person. If you move away from that and you do something like positive, you become a positive person. So it's not a contradiction that some of these people maintained evil, were evil their entire life. So some of them, that was part of their past. They probably would have liked to have forgotten about it. I'm not saying we should allow them, or that's not my point. My point is that really people can be two different people depending on what you do, the environment. And that's why the Sefer HaChinuch says there's so many mitzvot in the Torah. Do this, do that, do this, do this. It's all about developing our character. But the way to develop our character is the way we act. So it's more important that we help the guy we hate his guts to load the animal. Yeah, the animal will have to suffer a little bit more, but that's more important, of course, because again, the animals are for the benefit of man. So that's just alte bas l'chol adam. Everybody has a role and a place, and we have to treat even the convicted murderer. Rav Soloveitchik in J.J. Schechter's book on, you know, after the Rav died, so they put out about 10 or 12 books in English. You know, the Rav wrote in a lot of the manuscripts that he had prepared, not for publication. So people, the Meyotzer HaRav, they went through all these books and they put it together. They developed the themes all together. So J.J. Schechter did the one on Keynote. I'm sure many people know Rav Soloveitchik after his wife died. And, you know, the Rav lost his brother, his mother, and his wife in a three-month period in 1967. They all died within 3 months. And the Rav, people who knew the Rav before and knew the Rav after, he was a very different person. He was a terror in shir. Before, like I said, I mentioned before, Rav Schechter, you sit in the front, when he would tie his shoes, the nine people, you know, behind him would tie their shoes because nobody wanted to be seen. The Rav would call on you and, you know, fill you into a corner. He was a terror, and he mellowed a lot. So I believe the Feuerstein family, it was the president of the OU and Malden Mills, if you know that whole story, the Feuerstein family, big builders of orthodoxy in Boston, they suggested to sort of to cheer up the Rav, come to learn Torah. When you teach Torah, it makes you happy. Learning Torah is a joyous experience, meant to be joyous. So they asked him, so they recommended that he start teaching Torah in the summer in Boston. That's when the Rav started all the people sort of a little bit younger. I mean, a little bit older than me, but whatever, a little bit younger than the first generation, you know, would go to Boston and learn in the summers with the Rav. And that's when he started doing his keynote on Tisha B'Av. The Rav would sit literally from 9 a.m. or whatever till 5 p.m. He would just sort of read it's like he was saying the keynote to himself. He would read the keynote, and every line or two he'd stop. Like he wouldn't get through very many of them. You know, he'd stop after one line and give a 20-minute explanation and go on for 8 hours. Literally, I'm not exaggerating when I say he would go till 5 o'clock, and then 5 o'clock he would go to visit his wife. The cemetery. He would go apparently on Tisha B'Av. Anyways, so J.J. Schechter collected a lot of these, you know, of his talks, and he put, I forget what it's called, I have it in the back there somewhere, the Rav's on Aveilut and Tisha B'Av. And I remember when the Rav's talking on tshuva and the power of tshuva and, you know, how it works. And then he sort of raises the question, what about Nazis? What about Nazis? Can they do tshuva? Can their tshuva be accepted? And he leaves it sort of unknown. If we really believe that everybody can do tshuva, and even from the greatest of sins, the worst of sins, I mean, you know, we can do tshuva. So maybe, why shouldn't it apply to Nazis, yimach shemam? On the other hand, how can we say that? I think, you know, we in the the Rav Osso got out before, but people who didn't go through the war, or people for sure, anybody went through the war in the generation, how can we say that? This is like the scum of the earth. So he kind of leaves the question hanging. In other words, when we say that tshuva always helps, every rule has an exception. We'll get there in 1 second on Chil Hashem. But anyways, but every human being, are there exceptions? I don't know. It's like Rav Lichtenstein a little bit, we wrote on the Brother Daniel case. So we know that there's halachic definition of a Jew. You're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish. Can you lose your status as a Jew? A little bit, you probably can. There are, it's not as simple as you think. That I have a Jewish mother, and that's what in the Brother Daniel case, he would be converted during the war. He was saved by the parents, put him into saved him with Catholics. He became a Catholic, and then he converted. Then he after the war, he wanted to come to Israel. He's on the law of return. He's Jewish, as a Jewish mother. It's 100% halachic Jewish. And the Supreme Court ruled no, that by identifying with another religion, you lose your status as a Jew. Now, of course, the Supreme Court wasn't giving a halachic analysis, but there is some halachic truth to what they say. That's for a further discussion. Judaism is not just you're born of a Jewish mother. And that's the flip side. We spoke in what we call, Zer Yisrael, a person born of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother. Maybe our conversion standards should be a lot lighter. That's one of the ways to tackle the Russian issue in Israel. Again, I don't want to get into the halachic, and of course it mixes into politics, unfortunately. But, there are many who say there is a concept. It's not that he's not Jewish. Someone who's brought up thinking they're Jewish, or someone, let's say they're converted not according to halacha, but they're brought up as a Jew, they identify as a Jew, they say they're Yom Kippur. Okay, they're not halachically Jewish, but they're not the same as a non-Jew on the street. It's clearly not the same. Anyways, that's just something to think about. Okay, so that's Mishnah Gimel. Let's move on to Mishnah Dalet. Rav Livyatas Ish Yavna Omer. Rabbi Livtai Livitas Ishavna. So I guess I difficulty pronouncing it because I've never heard of him before. No one's ever heard of him before because he appears here. I've mentioned a couple times, mentioned in the first class, that there are 22 rabbis. Well, it includes Anshei Knesset, Agdola, and Yoshua. But okay, let's say there are at least like 20 rabbis who are mentioned only in Pirkei Avot. That's it. No, because we said they were specialists in ethical teaching. You have legal theorists and legal specialists and Maggadic specialists. Rabbi Lutayitz is one of these people. He's mentioned here once and only once, the only time he's mentioned. But I actually find it quite amazing. Ish Yavne, that's what they call him. So when they say Ish Yavne, it doesn't mean he lived in Yavne. I mean, he may have lived in Yavne, but if he came from Yavne, Miyavne, we don't identify Rav Misura. We normally we don't call people by their cities. We sometimes call them by their occupation. So when we say somebody is Ish Yavne, it means he was the most. Apparently, it means he was the most outstanding and most amazing. He epitomized what's Yavne. Who you want to know what Yavne is? Go to Rav Livtayas. He is the man who best represents Yavne. So that's like an amazing. Now, Yavne, of course, would say Judaism. We're only here today because of Yavne, because Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, instead of fighting for the lost cause to save a meaningless temple that had lost all value, decided to rebuild, Judaism from scratch in Yavne. And that's what saved Judaism, and that's why we're here today. So it's pretty, I just find that as an interesting idea. Now, he's going to talk about the importance of humility. So I don't know, maybe this is too much of a homiletical, stretch, but I do think there is something to the fact that stretching humility, we don't know anything about him. He doesn't appear. Rav Soloveitchik, right, in the Yom Kippur Machzor, is where I first saw it, that they put out the Rav. So the Rav writes, it was never popular to study Jewish history. That's a whole other discussion. Or to rabbinic biographies, this is a 20th century phenomena. Art Scroll is very into rabbinic biographies. Every gadol and whatever, how they find great rabbi dies, in a year or two, they write books. They write great. They have one style of writing books. And then, of course, really the idea of academic biographies is also a recent field. Like I think, Dr. Chorsky, the Rav's son-in-law, the Talmud Rebbe, the head of department at Harvard. So it was under his auspices, really, that some of this developed. He himself wrote his PhD on the Ravid, the critic of the Rambam. In other words, it's a critical analysis, not just all the stories, how wonderful he was, and he knew Shas at the age of three. These are critical historical analysis. And Mark Shapiro, of course, on the Sri Deish, that's a little bit more popular. But this genre of writing that, yeah, and you have an Israelite, they wrote on the Nodi Behuda, Dr. Brown wrote a 900-page book on the Chazon Ish, these are analysis. So this is a new 20th century thing. It's very, very interesting, and maybe they're very important, and historical trends demand different things. But the Rav says that was never the way in Jewish history. We don't have books about, nobody wrote a book on Rav Yosef Karo or the Rama, or even who the Rambam. No, nobody in that time wrote. History wasn't much of a field for anybody. So these are all new things. But the Rav puts it in sort of ideological ideas that it's unimportant. I'm saying it's a critique of today. In other words, the role of the rabbi is to be anonymous. The role of the rabbi is to create, or at least after he passed away, to create a society, right? Right. We all know the greatest people are people in the background, right? There's somebody who takes all the credit, but it happens in the background. The role of the rabbi or the role of the great leaders is to sort of be in the background. Obviously, if they have to take a leadership position, this came up on the Wednesday class on Sneud, actually. I didn't think of it. Now, as I'm talking, I think of it. Lori Novick was talking about, where she's giving a topic now on women in Kriyat HaTorah. So she quoted sort of Rav Schachter's view that it's a problem. The woman getting an aliyah is a problem of Sneud, of modesty. But Rav Schachter says it's also a problem for a man to get an aliyah. It's also a violation of Sneud. In other words, his definition of Sneud is anything you do in public. Judaism is very private. We don't advertise our mitzvot. We were supposed to be very modest. That's what he's going to teach. Be very, very modest. So nobody should have a public role. Nobody. But society can't exist. Somebody has to have a public role. No, somebody has to. We'll let the men ruin their... I'm not saying I agree, disagree. I'm not saying it's the only view, but that's his sort of worldview on what Sneud is. That then maybe it's based on the Rav. I don't know. But and it could be, perhaps it changes. But everybody should want to be private. That's so opposite the way we think today in our society. But in theory, everybody should want to be in the background. Somebody's got to be in the foreground. Okay, we'll let them in. That's why when they ask you if you want a dove, and you're supposed to say, no, I don't want a dove, and three times, okay, they bug you. Okay, I got to do it. What can I do? So so the Rav says, we don't know who the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were. The people who saved Judaism, right? The first time who saved Judaism, Ezra. So we know there's Ezra. Perhaps Mordechai, rabbis identify Mordechai, but that's it. There are 120 people. Can you name any of them? And he says that's the way. Books were often written anonymously, and people were not interested. It was a whole different approach. So that's perhaps Rav Liev Tayis Ish Yavne. In other words, that's great. It's great. We don't know about him. In a sense, you would say. I don't know. You can think about that, and you can say you don't agree at all. The Seder. But it's Ish Yavne, the man of Yavne, the greatest person in Yavne. So what does he say? He says one idea. But if we take this one idea, then life will be a lot better. Ma'od ma'od havishva ruach. Very, very much. Ma'od ma'od bishval ruach. Now, what shval ruach mean? Well, humble, of lowly spirit. Now, we know, of course, everybody knows that the only trait that the Torah describes about Moshe was he was an anav. He was humble. Other traits we know about Moshe, just we read the stories. But the only thing Torah says, and we know that those who say vayitin lecha, which is probably not so many people, on Saturday night, we say every week, wherever we find the greatness of God, there we find his humility, that God, El Gadol v'Nara, Osem Mishpat Yatom. God helps the orphan, the widow, you know, that the people in society we often don't take care of. That's what God does. The greatness and humility go together. They're kind of opposites, right? Greatness in a certain sense is the opposite of humility. But that's the whole point. Greatness, the greatness in Judaism is the being humble. So that's his teaching. On more Evishval Ruch. And as the Bartanura and others point out, of course, this is an exception to quote unquote the golden mean, which of course began with Aristotle and then picked up by on our tradition, the Rambam, that we should always be in the middle. You shouldn't live in poverty. You shouldn't say, you know, I don't want any materialism. We want only spirituality. No. And you shouldn't be too, you know, money. You got to find the happy balance. Where that balance is, I don't know exactly. But in every trait, as the Rambam writes, there's, you know, the extreme here and the extreme there, and they're in the middle. We always have to strive moderate. Jews have to, Dr. Lam, I think, used to say, we have to be extreme in our moderation. We have to be, you know, extreme moderates, whatever. Okay. So the Rambam says there are two exceptions to the golden mean. One is this Mishnah, being modest. We shouldn't be, okay, I'll be a little modest. I want to be too modest. I like a little bit of honor, kavod. You should be in the middle. No, you should be the extreme. Total modesty. We'll get to what that means in a second, I hope. The other one, of course, is what's the other trait that we shouldn't go in the middle? You know, a little of this is sort of it. We should go to be an extremist. What's the other trait anybody want to say? I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but if you want to write it in. The other trait, the Rambam says we should be extremist and only go in one way, of course, is anger. You should never get angry. Never, ever, ever, ever get angry. And of course, it's funny, that's not the word. It's ironic and sad that that's what did Moshe in. Moshe, the most humble of all people, lost his cool a few times. That's clear. Moshe had a little bit of a temper. That's obvious in the Chumash. And, you know, Shimon HaHamorim and hitting the rock, and that's ultimately what cost him. There's even a midrash. I mean, Nechama Leibowitz quotes this midrash in her studies. It's kind of whoa. Like, you know, the whole opposite of what we're always taught, okay, Elu Velu, that the reason God ultimately didn't let Moshe go to Israel is because he killed the Egyptian, you know, when we first met him back in Egypt. Yeah, how could you kill someone created B'Tselem Elohim? I'm not saying that's a dominant view, but I'm not making this up. Don't shoot the messenger. So I think Nechama Leibowitz in her studies in Sefer Shmot quotes, it's a power. Again, and these midrashim are not even necessarily meant literally. It's the idea, what we were saying before, everybody, wait, take him to court. Well, you can just kill a guy because he's beating up somebody, whatever. So Moshe, and we know, I think I mentioned last year, the Tiferet Yisrael has this beautiful description, the end of Kiddushin, how Moshe, we won't get into the whole thing, Moshe said, you know, I really have very weak character, but I worked really hard on myself. Like I do have a temper. I'm arrogant. I'm all these things by nature. But you know, I worked really, really hard on myself, and I became, you know, 99%. Okay, nobody is perfect. So it's kind of ironic that Moshe Rabbeinu, who's the great humble, the most humble ish, he's the person that anger got him in. Those are the two traits that you have to be extreme. Now, normally people are humble, are not angry. I mean, okay, there are always exceptions, you know, but if he wasn't, because being humble means I don't get so upset about everything. It's in Dafyomi 2 days ago, and Lavim Veinam Olvim, that you get insulted, you don't insult back. That's a great quality. Halavai, our politicians would have that. Or other people would have that. Like they insult you. You don't have to answer an insult with an insult. The Gemara says, the Gemara talks about when what happens if you insult a Torah scholar? Should the Torah scholar take revenge, etc.? But there the Gemara quotes the idea that great people, you know, so somebody insults them. So I try hard to do that. You know, people criticize, but let them criticize. You don't have to answer back. Sometimes their criticisms are valid. So anyways, but those are the two traits. So here's talking about ma'od ma'od havishval ruach. This is one of these, you know, mishnas you read and say, oh God, what a depressing mishnah. The hope of man is worms, you know, tikvat enosh rima. What are you arrogant about, right? What are we so arrogant about? We're all going to end up, you know, in the grave, and the ants are going to eat us. The bugs. Well, who? You're here today, gone tomorrow. There's nothing to be arrogant about. That's one way to interpret it. The Tiferet Yisrael, so it's, I think it's beautiful. He says, "Tikvat Anosh Rin." What's the connection? It's not so much that why be arrogant because you're gonna, you know, you were gonna die, and you know, it's just it's silly. You know, we look back at the things we got so excited about, you know, in perspective of time, you know, we all know that time is a great healer, and we can look back and etc. So, but he says like this: it's when we die that we find out how great a person is. I don't mean we who are survivors. I mean, I think what he means is the person themselves. It's only in the Olam HaEmet. This is an Olam Sheker, as we see every day. A world of mistruths, and the liars get ahead, and it's depressing a little bit, but also that's our rabbis coined it like this a long time ago, and that's human nature. What can we do? We humans, it's all the Midrashim that say, why do you give humans the Torah? They're a bunch of sinners and lowlifes, right? That's when Moshe got Torah. So that's why we need a Torah, because we're lowlifes and sinners and we're arrogant by nature. That's Ki Yetzer Lev Adam Raminu Rav, of course. That, and a lot of that is good. We couldn't, in other words, if we can channel that, it's great. We need that. God had to create it. But that's why we need the Torah, because we're like that. Some people don't channel those negative inclinations. So, but he says the true greatness of the person is never going to be in this world. It's going to be in the next world. It reminds me of the story. The Gemara in Bava Batra says that Rav Yeshua's son was sick. I don't exactly know what happened there exactly. You know, they write today, you know, these near-death experiences. People came back. They thought their ECG went flat, and they were basically dead. And then they revived them. And, you know, they give you descriptions of what they saw in the other world. They have books written about this, I believe. I haven't read any of them. But anyway, his son, he said he fainted, and I guess he sort of died. And they said when he came to, when he revived, his father asked him, what did you see? So he said, Olam Hafuch Ra'iti. It's a famous where I saw an upside down world. The people who are on top in this world, the big shots, they're pretty low down there, upstairs. And the nobodies down here, oh, you should see them in Shemaim. They're really, you know, they're the cream of the crop. They rose to the top. So his father told him, no, he says, Olam Baruch Ra'iti. Ra'itai said, you saw the clear world. You saw what the world is really like. It's a very powerful Gemara. And we know that it's true. Some, you know, I we know this. It's, you know, people, the facades, what we give credit to and who we put on top, isn't always reflective. So that's how the Tiferet Yisrael explains the connection between Mod Mod Shavish Faruach. It's not just, okay, what are you arrogant about? You're going to die. You're like in 50 years, nobody, or 120 years, no one will ever have heard of you. Who's going to care about you? So, you know, do what's right. Don't, you know, it's not just that. It's that it's only upon death that the true life of the person, you know, we can be determined. Okay, now, what's a shval ruach? So it's very interesting. And what does it mean to be humble? So I think there's a lot of misconceptions what exactly means to be humble. So the first thing that the Tiferet Yisrael distinguishes between an anav, the Mishnah doesn't say mo'od manav havi anav. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu was anav mikol adam. He was humble. Mishnah uses the term of shval ruach. So probably most people assume it's the same thing, you know, shval ruach, of low spirit and humble is the same thing. Says it's not the same thing. What's the difference? He says a humble person is somebody who knows he's great. He knows he's great, but he's not arrogant about it. That's very hard. I mean, you know, they say, you know, he's very arrogant. They say something, you're very, yeah, I have what to be arrogant about. You know, somebody says, I'm very humble. You have a lot to be humble for. You know, that's not such a nice thing to sell somebody. So an anaf means what? You don't think Moshe knew that he was an exceptional person, that God only spoke to him? Of course he knew he was special and unique, and God chose him to give to her. Anaf doesn't mean you think I'm a nobody. You know the old joke, I'm a nobody, you know, who does he think to be? You have to be a somebody to be a nobody. That's what it means. No, Anav doesn't mean you're a nobody and you think you're no. You're the trick, the difficulty of being a humble person is because you takadu of what to be arrogant about. Take a very successful businessman who's very sharp, Warren Buffett. I know Warren Buffett is, I think, quite humble from what I've never met him, but the way he lives his life and, you know, all that stuff. The guy is the greatest investor of all time. And you don't think he knows he's a great investor, you know, whatever. But it's how do you live your life? Are you going to say, oh, you know, I can do what I want, you know, whatever. And you look down upon people and you lord over people. The trick of being an Anav is, despite the fact that you really are great and you do have what to be arrogant about, you act in a way, you're kind and right. You're helpful and you're personful. Okay, so that's an Anav. That's not what the Mishnah, I mean, maybe that's the Mishnah includes that. A Shval Ruach is one who knows he's a nobody. He puts on airs. He got a lucky break. Well, he's wealthy. He's wealthy because he was born to the right parents. So his parents left him $10 million. So he's a big knucker. He's the president of the shul and of the school and this and that. And he walks around with the big thing. And but he's really a nobody. He's stuck a nobody. I mean, everybody's a somebody. But I mean, he's not really as great as it would appear to be. So a Shval Ruach is somebody who deep down, or I may be Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe thought he was when Moshe Rabbeinu said I was arrogant and angry and all that. So at that point, he's saying he's a Shval Ruach. You grow from a Shval Ruach to be an Anav. So he's, and he says, even if other people don't know, people think you're greater than you are. So that's what he says. Mod mave Shval Ruach. So basically what he's indicating, we should always look at our weaknesses. Don't focus on our strengths, but deep down, I think that's what he's saying. We have to look down on our how weak we are. A Shval Ruach. So an Anav is somebody who really is great. A Shval Ruach is really somebody who is, people think he's greater than he really is. And of course, the key is to use your greatness for, only positive person. Now it's interesting, ma'od, ma'od. Very, very much. I don't know. I was trying, what's the significance? Okay, mod mod means it's emphasizing. Great. Very, very much. Be Shval Ruach. I don't know if it means anything. I was trying to think. I could remember. Please add if you know more. I can think. I didn't look it up in the Concordia on the top of my head. Mod mod appears twice in the Chumash. Maybe it's more. It appears in Ubnei Israel, Paru v'Yishutzu v'Yiribu b'Me'od Me'od. When we first went down to Egypt, we exploded in numbers, b'Me'od Me'od. Anybody, maybe there's more time, but the other time it appears in the Chumash that I could recall was in the story of the Meraglim. After the Meraglim said that we can't conquer the land, so Yoshua and Caleb says, no, Tova Aretz Me'od Me'od. The land is very, very great. I don't know what's the connection. Maybe these are sort of transitional moments in Jewish history. I don't know. Maybe this is a transitional character of a human being, but I don't know. I'm throwing that out there if anybody has any thoughts with the expression ma'od ma'od. It's not such a common expression. Very, very much. And of course, that's what we picked up on the Rambam. We are conflating. I think the other commentaries do conflate anivut and shval ruach, where we don't say the rule of the of the golden mean. Okay, then Rav Yochanan ben Brucha Omer. Kol machal Hashem semayim b'seiter nifreim imena begalui. Whoa. Whoever desecrates God's name in private, we exact punishment for him, nifreim imenu begalui, in public. It will, you think it's in private, you're going to get in public. Echad shogeg v'echad mezid b'chilul Hashem. One, whether you do it accidentally, that's very interesting. You can desecrate God's name accidentally. We know when a business person cheats, when a person wearing a kippah cheats, so that's chilul Hashem, not b'shogeg. That's chilul Hashem b'mezid. But when we'll have to discuss in a moment what our case is chilul Hashem b'shogeg. You don't understand you're doing anything wrong. Maybe you're not even doing anything wrong. Just in the context, you create a chilul Hashem. So the Mishnah says it doesn't matter. Wow. Normally, there's a big difference if you do shogeg or not. But it's not. So first of all, the connection. Now, even it's interesting. This is a different person. This is Rav Yochanan ben Brucha, who does appear in the halacha more. He's not just only here in Pirkei Avot. It's not as common as many other Tanaim, but interesting. I don't know whoever put the numbers in the Mishnah, but this isn't from Misinai, but it's included in the same Mishnah. In other words, they didn't make this a separate Mishnah. And that the idea to be very humble and not to desecrate God's name is put in the same Mishnah. And that's probably because those who are arrogant are the types of people who are going to create a Chilul Hashem, right? It's the arrogant ones who sin more because, they think they're very great. That's on a very, on a practical level. That those who are arrogant will create a Chilul Hashem. The more classic meaning, or what I would say, is the Gemara in Sota has an entire side of page of Gemara of discussing how terrible it is to be arrogant. It's like kind of frightening when you read it. It's really, really it's not good. Now, what's it doing in Sota? So the Gemara, it's fascinating what the Gemara says. You can think about it. We're not going to get a whole discussion about this, but the Gemara says that one who's, they call it a gas ruach, that's the opposite, gas ruach, and he has very haughty spirit. One who is arrogant, a gas ruach, he's the person, he'll sin with Eish Chedish. He is the person he'll have an affair. It takes a certain sense of arrogance to tell you do you think she's married to you? Who are you? I'm going to take your wife and whatever. So that's how the Gemara gets into a whole discussion, because Masechet Sota is about the husband who suspects his wife is having an affair. It's a very sad picture, but okay, that's the Torah is a book of the real world. And but by the way, Sota is a fascinating Masechet. I mentioned earlier, the last Mishnah in Sota, when people die, talk about Mashiach. The last three chapters have absolutely nothing to do with the husband accusing his wife of adultery. The last three chapters in Sota is what you can say in any language. That's actually fascinating. Because the question is that the Sota, they have to read something. They have to say, she has to take an oath. So does that have to be in Hebrew? Or so that's, and then the Mishnah, the last three chapters is what things can be said in any language and what things have to be said in Hebrew. So for example, Birchat Kohanim, you can't do it in English. Davening, you can do in English. Kriyat Shema, you can do in English. Birchat Hamazon, you can do in English or French or Portuguese. Obviously it's not English only. And that's the last, and then talk about Egla Rufa. We didn't kill this person. Right, so Masechet Sota talks about so many fascinating things. It's really a very fascinating Masechet, and even this part about the husband and wife adultery. There's a lot of fascinating teachings there. The whole discussion about a woman learning Torah is based on the Mishnah in Sota. We discussed this because the Mishnah says that a woman who has other merits, I think it's such a beautiful insight and a beautiful idea of the rabbis. The woman may have committed adultery. Adultery is one of the three cardinal sins you have to give up your life for. No, she did a terrible thing, but you know what? She may be a wonderful woman. People make mistakes. She made a mistake. She made a terrible mistake. So she has other wonderful qualities. So the mission says the other wonderful qualities will push off the Sota water impacting on her. And then the whole discussion, even the fact that, we can recognize, that's the whole beauty. The rabbis always recognize the complexity of man. Moshe Rabbeinu can be great. Everything, we're complex beings. So Masechet Sota is a fascinating Masechet. And then in the end, it talked about all the people who died. I forget now exactly how they got into that. They talked about certain laws they made when the temple was destroyed, certain things. Okay, but anyways, back to the beginning, what we were saying. So one who is arrogant, the Mishnah says, the Gemara says, that's the arrogant are the people who are likely to have an affair. So then the Gemara talks about all the things of someone who's arrogant. He worships idol. He's an Ove Kochavim. He's a Kofer Be'ikar. Whoa. He denies the essence of Judaism. An arrogant person denies the essence of Judaism. That's pretty, why? It's not nice to be arrogant, but denies the essence. That's what the Gemara says. So we don't have time now, maybe come to exactly examine each one. But then the Gemara, and the one I think related to our Mishnah, is the Gemara says that when a person is arrogant, God says, Anibahu, I can't live with him in the same world. There's not enough room, right? There's not enough room for me and him, so I'm going to leave the world. There's no space. The arrogant, right? Obviously, because an arrogant person thinks he knows it all. He doesn't need any help. He doesn't need God. He doesn't need anything. So an arrogant person drives God away. So I think that's the connection here. In other words, be very humble, because those who aren't humble are the people who might create a chilul Hashem, but the act of being arrogant in and of itself drives away God, because as God says, there's no room for me and him. Okay, so that's what these kolam achal shem shemayim seitan. Now, let's finish up with the two definitions of chilul Hashem. It was last week's parsha, the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem was in last week's parsha in Amor. So what here exactly is a Chilul Hashem? So again, this is lots to talk about. So I'll take the Tiferet Yisrael, because I use him a lot, and he's in the classical Mishnah. So he says there are two types of sinners. There are two types of Chilul Hashem. He says what the Mishnah is not referring to, as he claims, is the type of a chilul Hashem where somebody sins because their desires get the better of them. In other words, it's a chilul Hashem, a sin done in public. Here, a sin done in public, even as he puts l'teyavon. You're not rebelling. You know, we have you cheat in business because you like money and everybody does it. You know, what can I do? I'm weak. I know I'm wrong. We do Lashon Hara. I know it's not right. I know I shouldn't say this, but I can't help myself. I get pleasure out of putting other people down. That's also a form of arrogance. Of course, Lashon Hara is connected. But he says like this. So he says, so what's the Chilul Hashem here? So much he says, he should have sinned in public. If you can't control yourself, sin in private. What does he mean? So this, he refers you to a Gemara, famous or unbelievable Gemara. The Gemara in Chagiga says, if a person eats raw meat, your inclination to sin is like really, really strong and powerful, and you can't control yourself. So what should you do? So there is a Gemara in Brachot that says you schlep the Yetzer Hara. There the Gemara doesn't say you can't control yourself. It says if the Yetzer Hara attacks, you schlep him to the Beit Midrash, learn Torah. Hopefully that will help. So good of it sounds like very, you know, frumish, but it's like there's a lot, you know, in that, you know, when I engage in something meaningful and intelligent, it sort of weakens the Yetzer Hara, schlep him to the base, moshcheyu lebeit midrash. The Gemara says, if that doesn't work, say Kriyat Shema. Shema Yisrael Hashem, contrary, there's one God, think about God, maybe they'll stop you. And then the Gemara says, if that doesn't work, think about Yom HaMitah. We discussed earlier, think about the day you're going to die. You think about an Ashrima, there's a bunch of worms. Maybe that will help. That's the Gemara in Bracha. The Gemara in Chagiga, which, I don't know, parallel, different, whatever, there it says, Yitro Mika Berlap. It's too powerful. So what should you do? You get dressed up in black clothes. This is really one of the sources of why, you know, in the yeshiva world, they dress them in black, or that's based this and another Gemara. Greg dressed in black, yitateh bishcharim, go to a city where nobody knows you and sin there. Because otherwise it's ichilul Hashem. If you sin here and everybody knows, everybody sees, that's a terrible desecration of God's name. But if nobody knows who you are, you're a great rabbi and you're going to sin. Unfortunately, you can't control yourself. So it's also a powerful idea of the sages. So, okay, at least if you go sin, you go where nobody knows you. We're talking pre-internet and pictures, people, it was very easy. Today, I don't know if this would work at all. Today, you can't hide yourself. But in the time of the Gemara, you could hide yourself. Go to another city and sin. So there's a fascinating machloket here. I don't know if it's Tosfot says the Gemara means what it says. The person should go and sin. He dress up in black, go to another city, nobody knows you, and go and sin. And he specifically rejects the interpretation. He quotes the Rabbeinu Hananel of Qayran, who wrote one of the earliest commentaries on the Gemara. He says, of course, the Gemara doesn't mean you should sin. That's ridiculous. However, the rabbis are going to tell us to go and sin. Rabbis mean, new. He's going to, I say, you know what? If I tell you can never sin, you won't listen. That's too hard. I'll tell you, you can sin. Wait 6 hours. Wait 2 days to sin. Get dressed up. Go buy some new clothes. Go travel to the next, and then you can sin. by 2 days the Yetzer Hara will go away. By dressing in black, doing all this, you'll learn not to sin. But if you told the person not to sin right from the beginning, it would never work. So you tell the person, here's the thing, how you can do the sin. And of course, the idea is he won't sin. Fastlane, Tosfot rejects that interpretation. He says, no, that's not what the Gemara means. Gemara means go and sin. I mean, it's not nice, it's not good, but sometimes you have to sin. What can you do? Your Yetzer Hara is too strong. I think that's just a fascinating argument. So here the Tver Tzio refers us to that Gemara. That's so that person who should be sinning in private, if he doesn't go to the Nuts Town and he just sins here, that's a Chilul Hashem. But he says that's not so much what our Mishnah is talking about. Our Mishnah is talking about a different type of Chilul Hashem. This is talking about the problem of the person who puts on airs that he's very religious, but he's not really religious. But he puts on a show. He puts on a show. He looks the part, but deep down he's a mean, and as he puts, a mean and not because he doesn't believe in any of the stuff. We have a lot of that nowadays. I am not sure I totally agree with what he's going to say. So he says, so he pretends to be a religious Jew. So when he sins in private, it's actually worse, because what he's trying to do is put on a show. I'm a great guy. I'm not going to sin. You know, he's hiding his truth. The first guy is like, he's really a good person. He's a religious Jew. And if he would sin in public, first of all, it would be a desecration of God's name, but it also destroy his reputation. And that's not fair. One sin shouldn't destroy your reputation. Even this woman who commits adultery maybe shouldn't destroy her reputation, right? So he can go away. But the person who really is a nobody but pretends to be a somebody, and deep down he doesn't believe in the whole system, so his sinning in private is a way, you know, it's just a whole show. So that's he puts sort of a worse type of a Chilul Hashem, and that's the type of person who eventually will be exposed. As if, I don't know if that always happens, but that's what the Mishnah is saying, that Nifrim Imenu Bigalui, that you'll be exposed in public. So it's interesting that, so there's the Chilul Hashem. In other words, to the outsider, it doesn't matter why you're sinning, right? To the observer, when you see a sin in public, it doesn't matter. That's why we want the person to go away. But when the person who's really is just putting on a show, so in a sense, his sin in public is worse. That's kind of what we have by the Ganav and the Gazan. He's more afraid of man than he is of God. He won't sin of other man. Well, he puts man on a higher level than God. So that's wrong. But a person who doesn't put man ahead of God, but he's weak, everybody has a weakness. So that's not putting man ahead of God when he sins in private. He's sinning in private because he doesn't want to desecrate God's name. And that's in a sense a positive trait. So it's very fascinating how your motivation for sin makes a huge difference on one level. It can make a very huge difference. We all know that the greater the person is, the greater the Chilul Hashem is. But I see it's 10:28, so maybe we'll pick up a little bit on this next week and continue, but just very quickly to review what we learned, and then I'll see if there are any questions. Don't be buzz l'chol adam. Everybody, everything has a place, even things, bats. Well, hopefully we'll find the cure for all diseases from animals. Mm-hmm. We'll and people, even disgusting people, anybody can take you down. Don't separate. Everybody's created in the image of God. And the Torah therefore emphasizes we bury even a convicted murderer. The Torah, and we have to help the person we hate load his animal before we help the person we love unload his animal. So you never know who, what, when, and where, but everybody's created the image of God. And then we talked about the importance of being a humble person, and that's the trait of God, and humility and anger, and the golden mean that a person is supposed to have. And the problem with arrogance, and the problem we have in this world, that sometimes the arrogant get ahead, but they really, in the next world, that's where we find out where the true identity of the person is. Our rabbis really, really don't like arrogance. They really, really don't. And you're an idol worshiper. I didn't go all the things. We drive God away from this world. The greatness of God is to be humble. The greatness of Moshe is to be humble. And the greater you are, of course, the greater the Chilul Hashem. You have to be concerned about how we desecrate God's name. But we appreciate there are people who sin, and sometimes there's nothing we do. And sometimes we even give you an outlet to sin. Because if we didn't give you an outlet to sin, maybe you'll destroy the whole system, right? People are human beings. Ain tzaddik bar tzesher lo yechda. There's nobody who can't sin. So Tosfot says, in other words, it's funny, Tosfot doesn't just say, this is what I say, and Rabbeinu Chananel says what he says. Tosfot says, no. And what Rabbeinu Chananel says, that this is just a method to get you that in the interim you won't sin. No, he's wrong. It doesn't fit in with the language of the Gemara. No, so that's just interesting. But listen, I find this very, very positive when the rabbis are very realistic, and the rabbis understood we sin, and sometimes people need outlets, and you can't just let them always, you know, how we do it. And that's what we were talking about, biographies, rabbinic biographies. You know, that's the difference between a critical biography and the hagiographies, where, you know, we only point out the good stuff. In a critical biography, I don't think there's anything wrong. I think that's the greatness of the person. We point out their faults. And Rav Huttner said that many years ago. You know, I'll end with this. I maybe Rav Lichtenstein commented, I believe, after the funeral of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He said he was at the funeral of Rav Aaron Cutler, died in 1962, and I believe, and then Rav Moshe died in 1986, 24 years apart. Totally different people. And he said, if you listen to the Hespedim, he said he gave the one exception was Irving Punim for Rav Aaron Cutler's, you know, funeral. He says, you would have thought the same person died. In other words, the Hespedim were exactly the same. This is a Torah, lost Torah. Says there was no appreciation of the personality person. He said, Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Moshe Feinstein were totally different personalities. I didn't meet either of them, but what I know about them, and having read, they're very different. And so often, you know, we gloss over everybody's this perfect picture. That's, that's not the approach. That was what Rav Lichtenstein was complaining about. To point out that somebody had a fault is not a fault. That's a strength we can learn. We discussed last week, were our sages perfect or not? Obviously they weren't, but can we point that out? Okay. Let me see if there are any questions here. Quickly, Tzaraim Tovim. Thank you, everybody. Yes, the theory of Nassim Taleb, right, on black swans, right? Sportion and role of high profile, hard to predict, and rare events that are beyond the realm of normal expectation. History, science, finance, and technology. Thank you for the proper explanation. Good. Yes, it blinds people. That's exactly what the mission is saying. We be afraid of the black swans. Refers only to unexpected events of large magnitude. Okay. Murder. I'm not sure what that's referring to. Somebody asked me pre-sign and reburial. So I need to learn it post-Sinai, like you taught. No, the burial of a murderer is written in Parshat Ki Tetze. Okay. We learn the idea of a minion from not the story of Stone. Yes. We learn it from the Meraglim. Halachically, from it's true that it could be it's connected. You're right, but the where Avram went down from 50 to 10. There's no 10. No, but that was more they can't influence the whole city. I imagine it is connected, but the halakhic derivation of a minion is toch, remove yourself from the midst of this congregation. And that congregation was 10 people. I mean, it was 12, but Joshua and Caleb made it 10. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Point is not about you, it's about the mitzvah. Eve, I'm not sure what you're referring to here. It's about the mitzvah. Yeah, about being arrogant. Yes, correct. We do what we do. The rabbis were willing to be anonymous. That's we give stock ideal. You should be anonymous, except practically you shouldn't be anonymous because you'll encourage other people, right? That's, again, the tension between the real and the ideal. Okay. Explain the connection between the Tiferet Yisrael and the words. Yeah, so I'm not sure always the words fit perfectly, but because it's often these explanations, but ma'od ma'od havishvav ruach. Be very, very humble or of low spirit. Shatikvat en ashrinesh, because the hope of man is we're going to die, is worms. So he's saying, because we're going to die, when we die, we're going to find out what we're really like, the true character. And therefore, we should be humble, because we can fool people in this world, but we can't fool God. you know, that's it. Here, man, we can fool people. Okay. Anyways, thank you very much. And I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. And Sunday morning, Daniel Feldman, the Halacha and Human Relations, and then Rabbi Liebtag. That's at 10 a.m. Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15. The Parshiyot leading up to Matan Torah. And then Monday morning, of course, Monday morning is Yom Yerushalayim. So Ari Shvat Shir will be on, I remember the exact title, but on Yom Yerushalayim, series on religious Zionism, Mark Spirit Night. We're finishing up the Chassidut and Megillat Rut on Tuesday, and finishing up Wednesday, Lori Novak and the woman and Kriyat HaTorah for Shavuot, preceded by Marty Lachenfest of Torah. This week's Parshat HaShavua Shir is being given by David Blackman. It's really cool. He lives in Australia. We'll be 8:30 at night. He'll be 12:30 Friday afternoon in Australia. This will be, I think, the first time we're going to have an Australian giving shiur. And I want to thank, actually, McKendron, one of the people who has attended some of our programs. She was in the States, attended our medical ethics conference last year, and she recommended her rabbi in Australia. And so sort of, you know, we're in contact with her, so he'll give the parshia this week. And then, please God, we'll see you all next week. And everybody have a wonderful day. Shabbat Shalom. We should hear good news and be safe and healthy and all good things. Okay.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat
Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. I brought up stone because it was again a negative. I brought up stone. I was wrong. It's the Meraglim, but again, it was a negative. That was
right. No, of course, the point is the same. Yeah, your point is the same. And I do think there's a connection. It could be Avram intuited. In other words, the rabbi is giving a technical derivation of a minion. But a lot of these things, there was an understanding that after 10, I mean, Rashi gives a whole explanation of who the people were, how we got to 10. But I don't think it's a contradiction. Your point is well taken. Yes, thank you. Okay.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.